you're listening on our public feed, which includes a shortened version of this episode. To hear the extended version and get access to our bonus shows, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com.
This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network, the home of great music podcasts. Visit us at fmpods.com.
You are listening to the Dilettantes Podcast.
Hey everyone, I'm Jim Salvucci of the Dilettantes, and welcome to the latest installment of Million Dollar Bash.
It's that Million Dollar Bash.
Last time, we discussed just the covers that Bob Dylan and the members of what would become the band recorded during the 1967 basement tape sessions. Today, we are back with part two to explore the Bob Dylan originals recorded during those sessions. The common explanation is that Dylan was cranking out new compositions during what was otherwise his bucolic hiatus in Woodstock, New York, in order to sell them to others to record. If that is true, then the recordings we have scattered across various bootlegs, Columbia's 1975 release entitled The Basement Tapes, and 2014, the bootleg series Volume 11, The Basement Tapes Complete, consists largely of rehearsals and demos. Of course, both Dylan and the band released some of the numbers themselves on separately recorded albums, including the band's debut, Music from the Big Pink. Whatever the rationale for composing these songs, performing them, and even recording them, we are fortunate to have this trove of musical delights. The songs range from the pretty but treacly All You Have to Do is Dream, takes one and two, to the deceptively traditional feeling Apple Suckling Tree, takes one and two, to the silly Get Your Rocks Off, to the playful See You Later, Allen Ginsberg, to the magnificent yet incomprehensible I'm Not There, to the magical You Ain't Going Nowhere, to the surreal Yay, Heavy in a Bottle of Bread, takes one and two, to the magisterial I Shall Be Released and on. As I list these songs, each jingles about my head, and I'm sure they are rattling around the noggins of most of our listeners now. So you're welcome. I would be remiss if I did not mention the evident influence these songs had on Todd Haynes' 2007 metabiopic, I'm Not There. Haynes has reportedly claimed his movie was greatly inspired by listening to a basement tapes bootleg over and over during a cross-country road trip, and many themes, snippets of dialogue, settings, and imagery directly evoke the Big Pink sessions. Now I'm going to stop here so that we can maximize the conversation with our Million Dollar Bash Whiz Kid Collective, and I'll introduce them. First up, we have Erin Callahan.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Straight from heaven, Nina Goss.
Hello. Nice to see everyone.
Grayley Heron.
Hello. Glad to be here.
And Rockin' Rob Virginio.
Hi, Jim. Thanks very much.
Unfortunately, Court Carney had a bailout at the last second, so we'll have to catch him next time. But we'll get going with this discussion. I have prepared no questions whatsoever. I just want this to be a wild take. So what are your thoughts? Who wants to open this?
Well, maybe because it's such a segue from your intro, I could just say that in listening again many times to the basement tapes prepping for this show, among the many things that strikes me, it's just the range. There's just so much stylistically and vocally and musically going on in the basement tapes. And though we've always known that Dylan has a wide range, and you could say, well, look at this album, then look what he's doing on this album, then this album, for it all to be in one big bundle like that is just remarkable. We talked last time about the ways in which Dylan may or may not be a kind of professor conducting an advanced level seminar to his pupils, the Hawks, later to become the band, with my favorite class clown, Richard Manuel, trying to crack the teacher up all the time. And there is that, but that's the kind of breadth the man has here. Just, it is an entire curriculum of music that he's compiled in this collection in such a brief time. It is remarkable.
That's a really insightful comment, Grayley, about because just the songs as that Jim listed off at the top of the show that are now ringing around in my head as they have been for the past couple of weeks. It is remarkable to move from This Wheel's on Fire to you ain't going nowhere to. It's not just the tone or the surreal yay heavy in a bottle of bread that Jim was talking about. It's not just the tone that changes, right? It's the structure of the song. It's the poetics of the song, the diction, the attitude towards it. It's like one after another. So that's really brilliant. And I absolutely agree. And therefore one can make the argument that he is reconnecting with his roots to a certain degree, but he is searching for a new sound as well. Perhaps one informed by those roots, but he's, as he always does, mutates and changes those roots to fit his own reflections on what's happening around him.
I think, I agree with both of you. And I think what always strikes me about listening to those, especially the 2014 release, is, and I guess with any of the bootlegs, that we get to hear him in process. But this is because it's such a departure from Blonde on Blonde to John Wesley Harding. We're seeing him in that transition and kind of work through that transition. And I think that's what's something that I love so much about going back to the Basement Tapes, is that you see, how he's working through that sound, like you said, to create his new sound and not just mimic the Roots music, but also create something that is so distinctly Dylan. And I think I see that in primarily like sort of that shift in Side of the Props, where we see something really beautiful happening lyrically, but also with his vocal and then just the different movements in that song as well.
So what else about the range here? This is a rich topic because, some of these songs are just, sometimes I'm a little surprised which ones are Dylan numbers. I'm Your Teenage Dream, right? You don't really think of that as a Dylan number. He's having fun there. Or, All You Have to Do Is Dream, which I mentioned before. That sounds like something right out of the 50s, right? It sounds like something maybe you heard somewhere. And then you realize, no, Bob Dylan wrote that. He wrote that for these sessions. What do you make of that? Why is he sort of going after these genres that are, frankly, in some cases, flat out hokey?
I think it's his way of writing and singing, and writing and singing his way out of 1966, out of Blonde on Blonde. He sings and writes his way into new states of being. I don't see that the songs aren't the result of some transformation that's occurring in him outside the recording studio. He's transforming through the songs. And that's what I find so fascinating about these, about the something like Tears of Rage, which is really, and Sign of the Cross, these are really complex, resistant, difficult songs where he's shifting tones and really trying to work out a new relation to the listener, to the audience. And he's really feeling his way through and such complex ways. So I really hear them. And I also think at this point, it's completely irresistible to see these, as Aaron is saying, as transitions to John Wesley Harding. And I don't know any way to avoid that. He didn't know that they were transitioned, that Sign on the Cross was a transition to the scriptural landscape of John Wesley. He didn't know that, but there's just no way for us to avoid that narrative, do you think? I have no way of listening to these songs without hearing them as stages in the pilgrimage to get to John Wesley Harding.
I think that's the benefit of the hindsight that we have now, is that we see him working through that in a way that he may not have been conscious of at the time, but then we're able to make that link as we're looking back on it. And I agree. I don't know that we can, clearly I see that narrative, but I think that we're in the position now that we can see how that works.
I'm obviously obsessed with John Wesley Harding, the album, and I agree, Nina, that you can't. Listeners at the time had this, they didn't have the Basement Tapes unless they had The Great White Wonder. So you had Blonde on Blonde, then John Wesley Harding. And I know an artist like Dylan revels in that kind of profound juxtaposition of styles. And I really love the way that you put that, that the scriptural landscape of that he didn't have that idea. He's working towards it, but you get this sense that that clutch of songs, John Wesley Harding, came in a rush, and there was something in writing Tears of Rage, perhaps writing this Wheels on Fire, perhaps, that lit a spark of some sort where he decided to double down on that particular tone, that particular conglomeration of various references and languages, and put that out. And then, of course, he leaves that kind of really intense poetic investigation aside. And this is me slagging off Nashville Skyline for something like Nashville Skyline that comes after. So John Wesley Harding stands out as this weird thing, but I definitely see these songs in the shadow of what comes after, that he's kind of searching here, that there's not some sort of like automatic transformation, as you said. Right.
I like Nina's point too, that it's impossible to listen to these basement tapes in a vacuum. It's impossible to divorce what we know or think about what came afterwards from what we, how we re-experience these songs, listening to them again in 2024. There's the immediate aftermath with John Wesley Harding and the Nashville Skyline. I'm sure Court would have jumped in here to defend and rest Nashville Skyline. I will not. I will let it drown. Whether it's waving or drowning, I'll let it sink. But, you know, he also didn't know that 1968 was coming. And that's a year that is very resonant for us in 2024, I think. And yet it feels like he did know. It feels like his songs are anticipating exactly where that's going and tapped into the zeitgeist in a way that's less literal, you know, less explicit than his earlier songs. You know, his Emmett Till and his Only a Pawn in Their Game and his Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. And yet equally feels eloquent in capturing the mood, the anxiety of the period. And John Wesley Harding, of course, does that brilliantly. But the other thing I was thinking of in listening to this is how much I love Dylan's voice in the 60s. He can do so many things with it. And though I love Dylan's voice now, more than anything, I've been immersed for the last couple of years in Rough and Rowdy Ways, and both on the album and the Rough and Rowdy Ways tour. And I love late Dylan's voice and songwriting. I love the depth and the subtlety, the nuance, the pathos of late Dylan's voice. But you go back to basement tapes and realize he had so many more clubs in his bag back then. And he uses them with the expertise of Tiger Woods at the top of his game, right? There are things that Dylan could not do in the 60s that he can do now. So I'm in no way shortchanging late Dylan, our current Dylan. But God, his best instrument has always been his voice, and he can do so many more voices in the 60s. And that's great to dive back into that very deep well.
I wish I could remember the first time I ever heard Sign on the Cross, because that, like Aaron mentioned, that vocal is, on earth does that come from? And he just hits that. And he holds on to it for the entire song. It's really extraordinary. I wish I could remember the first time I had that experience. Tears of Rage also is another one. How does he get that?
So that raises a good question. What was your first experience with the basement tape recordings? How did you encounter them, and how did you react?
When I was a super new to this world, and I just bought the official CD, and I was so horrified that they had those band songs. Like, who wants to hear this shit? The band songs. And then I redid the CD, taking all their songs off. So it was only, I was shocked that I had, that they were going to force me to listen to this. Other songs, but yes.
So what did you think of the Dylan song?
Oh, I loved Apple Suckling Tree so much. I thought I never heard anything so wonderful. And I thought that they were timeless, in a way that nothing that I had been listening to up to that were that they felt like folk tales. They felt like ancient, timeless folk tales. And then the dirty songs were shocking to me. Like, please, Mr. Sam, that's a very dirty song. Can we just get that out on the table? So, they were just sides. They were sides that were ramped up. The playfulness and the raunchiness are so fresh. And to this day, they're fresh and rich, I think.
Yeah, and I guess that timelessness, I like that idea. The fact that so many of these songs seem like they're just from a different era really kind of informs the feel of John Wesley Harding as well, right? Because that has a very similar ethos. Who else? Any other? Or actually, I'll tell you, my first encounter with it was the 75 Columbia album, maybe when I was in college. I think I just bought it. I'd heard about the Basement Tapes. I had no idea what it was. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. You know, I was a pretty good Dylan fan, but I wasn't real in depth. I'd seen him play once. And I was absolutely blown away. I had no idea what I was. I couldn't even figure out how to get my brain around these songs. They were just so crazy. The lyrics were so crazy. Yeah. I loved the raunchy ones. And I was a big fan of the band. And I had little love-hate with the band songs. Some of them I actually liked. But yeah, just as a whole, the Dylan numbers just were just, they just opened my eyes in a way and really made me look at all of literature very differently. Really kind of opened me up to a lot more. And I had already been pretty wide open by then.
Had anybody you read Tarantula before?
I wasn't aware of its existence. Yeah, no, I had no idea. I was, you know, not a very informed Dylan fan. Who else, you know, remembers their first encounter with this? Did anyone encounter through a bootleg, or was it the 75 album, or what?
I can tell you it was bootleg, and my friend Carrie Wynn Scott, who led me to most things Dylan. We were probably not sober, and we were listening to Dylan out on his porch, and it was Million Dollar Bash was the first song I heard, and that sort of became our sort of theme song for all of our adventures. But I remember, like you, Nina, and you, Jim, I wasn't so thrilled with the band songs. Everything Dylan loved, I did also love the raunchy songs. And since it's post-world, I saw sort of the connection to Dirty World.
Yeah.
You know, of course, I guess at the time, a thing I used to say was they bent my brain. Like, I just was like, this is one of the best things I've ever heard. All of the Dylan stuff, just literally, I wanted more. And you're right, the wordplay and the range of, you know, the wordplay in it, the strangeness of it, it made me kind of see things differently as well. And maybe because I wasn't sober. I'll take that. I accept.
It must have been strange. None of us were Dylan fans in the 60s and 70s. We came to him at various stages, but later. But if you were a Dylan fan back then, well, I guess you probably would have already heard The Great White Wonder or some form of bootleg version of the Basement Tapes before they were officially released. But how weird it would be if you didn't, for it to be a contemporary of Blood on the Tracks and Desire for you, rather than this, you know, rather than reinserting it back into the timeline that we always knew, right, of when it actually came and how it's really more a sister album of John Wesley Harding than it is has anything to do with Blood on the Tracks or Desire. So that would have twisted your mind in a different direction to experience it in the order it was officially released.
I got from a friend of mine, the Tree with Roots bootleg that we talked about last time. But I did come into contact with these songs through the official 75 release previously. And I have to go back to Grayley's statement about the stylistic range again. And I think that's what Aaron and Nina have been talking about, and Grayley right now been mentioning as well, talking about as well, is that this cornucopia exists, that it's just the surface. The 75 recording of a record. It's just the surface, and the shift in tone between something like Too Much of Nothing and Yay Heavy and A Bottle of Bread, the two songs that open up the second disc. I got the CD of the 75 recording that opened up the second disc, which was always my favorite. It was just, again, stunning to me. As Aaron said, bent my brain. I was like, you know, why in 1967 is he writing these incredibly playful, dirty, raucous songs, and then interpolating into that catalog something like Too Much of Nothing? It's just haunting song to me. Just an incredibly haunting song. That and This Wheel's on Fire, which ends the second disc of the 75 re-release on CD, those songs have just stayed with me as just incredibly haunting songs that I can't, they've got this, almost this aura around them that, you know, I can't pierce their complexities because they hit me in that kind of, that incredibly haunting way. The Waters of Oblivion and Too Much of Nothing, it just resounds in this way, right? And yeah, that was my first experience with these songs, seem to correlate with the others.
The urbanity is gone. The veneer of urban cool is gone. And I think that the emotion that emerges is what is alarming to us.
That's a really great point. That's a really good point. Because yeah, you
imagine any of these songs being sung at the Andy Warhol's factory.
Yeah, could right. No, exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe it's a vulnerability, Nina, like, that we're seeing.
Oh, absolutely.
Sort of, like, stripped down and pared down and, like, you know, sort
absolutely.
Of going back to what Court and what I was alluding to in Denmark is just like there's just he's freer to be vulnerable, I think, because of the people he's around, and that maybe they were just demos and he was just, you know, they were just riffing and having fun. But there he gets to that point of really a stripped bare emotional state that we see. And Tears of Rage is the one that always gets me, like, why must I always be the thief? Like I don't know why that line hit me when I was younger, but it still does. I still go back to the first time I heard it. Like, it hurts in a way. I don't know why, but yeah, he works to that place of emotional vulnerability there.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for here in the public feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode and get access to extended and bonus episodes from this and all of the other shows on the network, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com.
Thank you for listening to the Dilettantes Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to FM Pods to hear the complete podcast.